Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine, California, where we talk with authors, poets, literary agents, and editors about the art and business of writing. My guest today is Judith Handelsman, author of Growing Myself, A Spiritual Journey Through Gardening, published by Plume in 1996, that won a 1997 Books for a Better Life Award in the spiritual category, along with Thomas More's The Re-Enchantment of Everyday Life and Jimmy Carter's Living Faith, a featured selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club and One Spirit Book Club. Growing Myself has been translated into Japanese, Italian, and German. Judith also has teaching tapes through Sound's True Catalog called Spiritual Gardening. She wrote two books for children, Gardens from Garbage, How to Grow Indoor Plants from Recycled Kitchen Scraps, published by the Millbrook Press, Inc. in 1993, and Greenworks, Tender Loving Care for Plants, published by Macmillan in 1974, that sold 200,000 books. She's completed the pilot for a proposed cable television series called Inner Gardens for the Odyssey Channel, which she co-wrote and hosted. Judith Handelsman Smith is a former monthly gardening columnist for Vogue and New Age Journal, and a former gardening correspondent for NBC All News Network Radio. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's so good to see you again. This isn't going to be a typical gardening show or talk about gardening. This book is as different from any gardening book as anything I've ever seen. And I'm so curious because you had a job, or you had a business when you were in New York of keeping plants for businesses, taking care of plants, gardening, landscaping, all that. Where did you go? How did you go off into this slant? How did this book begin?
Well, I got bored just doing what I considered a surface job with gardening, because as I was doing this business, I became very driven to search for an inner life, and whatever that meant. I didn't even know what that meant at the time. I just had this phenomenal pull from within for spiritual development. And I happened to be working at All News Network Radio for NBC, and I was doing one-minute gardening spots five times a week. I was writing them and voicing them, which is another story altogether, what that writing process was all about. But I happened to sit in on an interview with Peter and Eileen Caddy from the Findhorn Garden in Scotland. They were in New York publicizing the Findhorn Garden book, and I was asked to sit in on an interview with them. And it turned out that they gave me the book to read the weekend before, and I had a major life transformation when I read the book. It changed my life overnight. And I was very, this was 1975, maybe, and the Findhorn Garden in Scotland was a mecca for gardeners from all over the United Kingdom, because they were growing giant vegetables and flowers through meditations with the nature spirits, they said.
Because the ground was sand?
It was sandy soil. It was cold. It was windy. It was on the northernmost tip of Scotland where nothing should have grown. And they were growing these amazing plants. And they said they were doing it through meditations with the nature spirits. They were getting direction from the Sweet Pea Deva and Pan himself. Hmm. So when they wrote about this, they had such a completely inner-directed take on our relationship as human beings with plants, what a spiritual relationship was developing when a gardener and a garden get together. Mm-hmm. I knew right away that this was my path for a while. And I guess you could say plants were my first experience of God, the G word, whatever you want to call God. And from then on, I was never the same, and my interests were never the same, because I was more interested in the inner life than whether your plant needs more sun or not. I always tell people plants live on your light.
So then how did the book begin? How did the idea for doing this book, which is totally unique, how did it begin?
I started having very amazing, miraculous, supposedly implausible experiences with plants as I took care of them. I had an apartment in New York City, and I wanted so much to live in the country, and I couldn't. So I decided to make a jungle out of our home. And I started having, I was spending an inordinate amount of time with the plants. I had trouble with people at that point, and plants were like pets to me. And I started putting into practice what the people at FinTorn were talking about, and so I started having amazing experiences.
Tell about the spider plant.
After this initial interview with the caddies from FinTorn, one of the things they said was to give plants 24-hour notice before you do anything to them, such as cutting them back, repotting them, transplanting them, anything major, just to give them 24-hour notice, and that it would prevent them from going into shock and give them time to acclimate and anesthetize themselves so they could be prepared and not go into shock. So that seemed reasonable to me, sort of. And I went home, and I had this pot-bound spider plant. And spider plants usually, well, they're tuberous, and you can cut them in as many pieces as you want and propagate them from the root ball, from little pieces of the root ball. So I decided to give this spider plant 24-hour notice that I intended to cut it back, and they didn't really tell you how to do this, so I introduced myself. I felt very awkward, but I introduced myself to the plant and said that I was offering myself in the spirit of cooperation, and would it help me help it? And I told it what I wanted to do and why. I showed it where I wanted to cut it in half. I made an invisible line across the top of the root ball, and I said, in 24 hours, I'll come back and I'll cut you in half. And this was usually a terrible process for me. I couldn't get it out of the pot. It wouldn't even budge. There was no give in the pot at all. I said, please give me a sign that this is okay. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And I said, I'll be back in 24 hours and help me get you out of the pot and cut you in half here. And I showed it two new pots of soil, hanging baskets of soil, fresh soil. And I said, it's ridiculous for you to be in this pot anymore. You have no nutrition whatsoever. Give me a sign. And in 24 hours, I came back, and half the foliage had flopped over to one side of the line I had drawn, and half the foliage had flopped over to the other side. And it wasn't gray or limp. It wasn't in shock. It had simply regrouped itself. It was like the parting of the Red Sea. Here was this plant that was showing me. It was making some sort of attempt at communication. Different kind of communication, for sure. The plant doesn't just talk, but it showed me something. And I got goosebumps. And I thought, well, I guess this is the sign. I didn't really know what I didn't know what to expect. I was ignorant, and I guess that was a good place to be. And I said, okay, and I thought I'd still have to bang it on the floor and still pull on it to get it out. And I turned over the pot, and the whole root ball just fell right out. Intact. No mess, no dirt, nothing. And it was heart-stopping. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, this is the last part. I had this big kitchen knife. No, sorry, the kitchen knife. I'm going to cut you in half where I showed you. Now, please help me, because this is the hardest part. It was grinding mm-hmm. away at the roots. It was like getting your teeth pulled or mm-hmm. something. And I took the knife and I started to cut it, and it went through as if the root ball were made of soft butter. And I potted it up, and it never went into shock, and I hung them together because I figured they were a family. Hung them in the window in a southern exposure, lots of sun, and they never went into shock. They just grew very well. And from then on, I never related again on a purely material level.
Mm-hmm.
I just developed a way of tuning in to plants. And so I started writing this book. For years, I was just writing these stories down. So they were stories unto themselves. Mm-hmm. Each one was an essay. They were an essay. Mm-hmm. Yes, they work on their own. And then eventually, I used to have a lot of pain because I was a writer I was a professional writer for a long time, but I never felt that the real book that was inside me was ever coming out. And I wrote very well, but I felt that I was not getting to the depths of my being. I wasn't really expressing myself so that I could feel like I had plumbed the depths of my being mm-hmm. to get this book out.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I had it in there, and I wanted it to come out so badly. It was painful. And I always thought of the saying that writers should write what they know. And I was always trying to figure out other things to write, because for a long time I kept saying, well, I don't have anything to say. I don't know anything. And suddenly one day it dawned on me that I could write what I know, but it was such a taboo subject. I thought I had missed my time, because in the 70s, when the Findhorn Garden was becoming famous and people were talking about communication with plants and the spiritual aspect of gardening, I thought, well, I've missed my chance. Nobody cares about this stuff anymore. And as it is, not very many people do care about it.
But your book's been in print for 4 years.
Yes, and
that's
it's a great critical success, and there is a niche market for it. But more importantly, it was the greatest release for me in the world. It was the greatest thing experience to get paid to sit for 2 years and write this book and put it together so that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a vacation for me. I didn't have to do anything else. I could just write every day and feel secure about it.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Judith Handelsman Smith, author of Growing Myself, A Spiritual Journey Through Gardening. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and stay with us here. It's only going to get better. So these essays started coming out. Did you publish them? Were they a part of what you were writing for Vogue or New Age Journal?
I did write the spider story in a different form, the replanting mm-hmm. of the spider plant for Vogue. They called it One Woman's Story, and it was a little offbeat for them, but they did it because I had a monthly column, and I definitely downplayed it, but the kernel of it was there.
Mm-hmm. So then what happened? Did you do a book proposal, or did somehow you meet an agent or a publisher?
All of a sudden, I became gripped in 1990, I guess it was 1995, 94, 95. I became gripped with this feeling that it had to get done, and I had to do it, and that the whole country was waiting for this book, because spirituality was becoming food for so many people. That there was this incredible thirst that people were having and still have. It just gets more and more and more. And gardening had become the number one recreational hobby in America. So I thought, well, the marriage of these two, this is what the world is waiting for. I have pretty high expectations of what, of the interest for this
sort of thing.
But I put together a book proposal, and I went to the library, because I had been published in the 70s and had a best-selling book, but then I had the children's book, which had won two awards, but to get an advance for a book like this, I needed an agent. I didn't have an agent at the time. I had done the other two books without agents, and I had been out of the major publishing world, the New York publishing world, for a long time. So I had to start from scratch. And I went to the library and I got a list of all the agents that take books like this from the, what's that, literary marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I sent out 25 queries. And I got 11 immediate responses of people who thought this was an interesting idea and wanted to see more. And then when I did that, there were people who really were dying to have it, but everybody wanted me to change things. Like, well, there's a chapter on my abortion and Petunias in My Inner Worth, it's called. And I thought that was the strongest chapter in the book. And all these people wanted me to take it out because it was so controversial. Mm-hmm. And it brings up a lot for a lot of people.
Sure.
And I said, I can't do that. And one said, this reads like an acid trip. You can't say those things. And already they were telling me what I couldn't say, you know, and I was writing this book for me, really, although I was also wanting to communicate to a large audience. I wanted it to be for mainstream. I wanted it to be for everybody because I was convinced that there were people out there who could relate to this.
So the agent that you ended up going
So the agent I ended up going with, I was starting to feel kind of discouraged because I was going to have to go with somebody who wanted me to change things.
And I thought to myself,
I want somebody who really loves this book and believes in it. And then suddenly, this woman named Connie Clausen called me. She was a legend in New York. She was a real character. She was right out of some kind of satire on New York agents. She was wonderful, and she said, I don't know how this slipped through the cracks. I just found it. Send me overnight, send me whatever you have, and let me read it, and I'll get back to you. And she did. She did Jonathan Livingston Seagull, and she said nobody wanted to read about seagulls. And she did Watership Down, and she said rabbits. Nobody wanted to read about rabbits. And she said, and this is another one of those books. Mm-hmm. And she just said it's so original, and it's a wonderful idea. Send me everything. So I thought, if she calls me back and says I love it, then it's for her. And because that was my fantasy of how it should be, or I wanted it to be. And sure enough, I waited there, and I waited, and I waited, and finally she called. And the first thing she said to me was, I love it. And I was just so happy. And then she helped me revamp the proposal, And she said one person wanted it from Simon & Schuster, and then she couldn't get it through the... There's a board. The editor's not by them, him or herself.
All the committees.
So she couldn't get it past that because they all said gardening. What do you mean? What? Huh? They're up on the top floor of some building in Manhattan, and they didn't really get it. But she really got it. And anyway, she said, you've got to have some kind of proof. So you need to go to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Where else did I go? There was some leading advertising magazine. I forget the name of it.
Proof of what?
Proof that people are interested in spirituality and interested in gardening, and that that there would be a market, there would be an audience for this. So I went, and because everything has to be spelled out now,
right?
Every little bit has to be spelled out. The marketing and sales is more important than the book itself, which was very sad for me to discover. My sweet little romantic notions were dashed. And so I got all this, I got all of this stuff. And to me, it just corroborated my feelings. And we wrote a great proposal, and she sold it for quite a substantial advance to Dutton. And I was floored. I was just floored because suddenly in my mind, I had been validated. My ideas had been validated. And it had been a long time. I had had a lot of rejection. People saying, nobody wants to read about this sort of thing. I had one agent say, nobody wants to read about your abortion and whether a tree was felled and your reaction to the tree dying and falling and being cut down. And that was astounding to me.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Judith Handelsman-Smith, author of Growing Myself. So throughout these rejections coming in, what were you going through? Were you thinking, well, maybe I should take it out, or were you... Take out that chapter, take out this, do this. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe they're right. Or did you say, no, there's someone out there who's going to like it, who's going to love it?
A little bit of each. I struggled a little bit, but it didn't make sense to me to change it because then it would just be like pablum. The whole point of it was to make a... the reason I wrote was to touch people. And to touch people deeply. I've never been interested in... I've only been interested in having people's lives change from reading what I wrote. That's what I wanted to do more than anything, because that's what happened to me. You know how it is when you read a book,
sure,
and it changes your life. One sentence can change your life forever, and you're never the same. And I wanted to do that. I thought I could do that. And I guess that I have baskets and baskets of letters saying that I did that for some people. And that feels really good, because... life can be really lonely when you feel things and see things that other people don't.
And now we're going to take a break and let all of you think on that. Don't go away. We'll be back in about 3 minutes and 20 seconds. So stay tuned, and I'll be back with Judith Handelsman-Smith, author of Growing Myself.
Come back, baby, please don't go. hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We've gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Judith Handelsman Smith, author of Growing Myself. And if you've just tuned in, we're talking about gardening in a way that most people don't talk about gardening. And we're also talking about writing. And we're talking about how this book, Growing Myself, A Spiritual Journey Through Gardening, came about. So, your book came out. How was it received? You got these letters. What happened with gardening magazines? Would they excerpt parts of it?
No, the gardening magazines, the horticulture magazines, didn't want to have anything to do with it. They belittled it. They looked down on it. They didn't belittle it because they didn't read it. They were not interested in anything that had to do with a spiritual take on gardening. They were, as a matter of fact, it pressed people's buttons. Yeah, it threatened a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of having a reciprocal relationship with plants, on the very surface, just talking to them, but on a deeper level, feeling the interconnection of all life and actually communicating at a heart level, that nobody wanted to have anything to do with that. I did go out and talk in lots of places. I gave talks to all sorts of people and clubs and arboretums and at the Huntington. I did a lot of lecturing, and I created a slideshow with music without speaking on the joy of gardens. Going from nature and moving in closer to civilization, and what people do with their houses and gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very touching, with panpipes. And I wanted to nourish people's imagination. And there were just so many people who resonated with how the garden grew them. And so many people had very deep experiences with plants, usually around some family member,
mm-hmm.
grandmother, grandfather. And the people who read it loved it, really loved it. And the critics loved, you know, it was a critical mm-hmm. success, but it was not the, it did not sweep the nation, let me put it that way.
There's such a moving chapter in here about the trees, the three trees that were cut down, and how do you go through life, actually, because I have a problem with this, but when you see trees being cut down that shouldn't be cut down, or you see wildlife replaced with parking lots or buildings, how do you deal with that in life? I mean, how do you keep all of that out?
I don't keep it out, and it's very painful. I think it's becoming more and more difficult if you're a really sensitive person to keep out, keep separate from the pain of nature and our attitude toward nature. People want everything clean and neat, so they cut down trees because they make a mess. Or I don't know how to deal with it. I think people need to come together and talk about it, because you need support. I have so much pain. When I hear chainsaws, I feel like they're cutting me. And I don't know what to say about this, because it can only be dealt with within. I don't know how to change what's going on. I live in Laguna Beach, and there's a lot of tree hacking, just mutilation of trees. I think one of the most difficult things now is that there are people gardening, passing themselves off as gardeners and lawn maintenance people who don't know anything about trees, and they're going in and hacking just so that for a buck. Mm-hmm. And they're giving people misinformation. So I think you really need to educate yourself about trees. Find people who know something, because trees do not have to be cut the way they're being cut in order to be healthy.
So when you were writing this book, and as you continue to write, do you work in an office? Did you write any of this book out in a forest, out in a meadow? Or do you have rituals where you put yourself in nature for a while and then you go to work? What do you do?
I alternate, because there's just so much time I can work, and then I need to refresh my mind. Because after a while, I don't know, I can't read it anymore. It doesn't make any sense. The words don't look right, and I don't know what it sounds like anymore. So I do take breaks. I alternate between gardening. I go out into the garden and I work a little, or I just sit. Mostly I like to putter and work, because that's very freeing and very relaxing and refreshing. I read that Thomas Jefferson did that, and I always liked that. He read six books at a time. He invented something that held six books open at a time, like a Lazy Susan with levels. And he had six books going at a time, and when he needed refreshment, he went into his greenhouse, because he was a botanist, and he was a farmer. He was into agriculture big time. So that's what I do, and sometimes I just stare. I have a window that looks out onto a garden, and I just stare. People think, well, I'm going to just sit down and write now. Or a woman told me, my husband says, well, I'll take care of the kids for an hour, you go right now. But it doesn't work that way. Writing takes a lot of time being on the back burner, so to speak. I'll spend time just sitting and staring and daydreaming and thinking and doing nothing.
So you teach a class here at UCI. What sort of things do you have your students do.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a more introductory type class?
Yes, this is for anybody. It's just a foundation for any kind of writing. It's at the extension, the inner game of writing. I'm always interested in the inner, whatever the inner part of doing anything is, because I think, particularly in writing, you can take all the writing classes you want, but if you don't have self-confidence and you haven't explored yourself, it's very difficult to write anything good. I think in order to write well, you have to really know who you are. And so I do a lot of exploratory work with the inner critic with my students. I teach them ways to jumpstart their right brain so that they can access unconscious material, which is very important, because if you just stay at a conscious level, it's going to be very boring and for you and for your readers. So I have people write. I actually have people write instead of just talking to them or them talking, because a lot of people want to write and they don't write. They talk about it, but they don't do it. Mm-hmm. And the only way to write is to write.
Imagine that.
What a concept. So it's really the same with anything. You have to practice. And I have the same problem with drawing. I really want to draw. But it doesn't come, I'm not facile. It doesn't come easily to me. And I know that in order to learn, I just have to do it. And when I do it, it takes so much concentration. I'm practically sweating bullets. But it comes out beautifully. And it's the same with writing. You know, the old line about writing is just sitting down and opening a vein. And I remember once reading that in order to write, I don't know anything about writing novels or fiction. So I'm really talking about personal writing here, personal essay writing, personal, something that's nonfiction. Expository or poetry. I think that you have to be willing to make a fool of yourself and not look good. And paradoxically, you'll end up looking really good to a lot of people because we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can tell your story in pictures, if you can paint a picture with words, using very concrete, everyday examples, you know, really describe something, an everyday situation, it'll have universal meaning for a lot of people. And people are just dying to connect in that way, to find other people, and they can say, yeah, I feel that way too, or yes, that happened to me too.
Because the personal is what's universal.
Right.
Even if the specifics are different. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Judith Handelsman-Smith, author of Growing Myself. Many nonfiction writers long to write fiction, or they also write fiction. And I only know a few writers who will say, I love nonfiction, I don't want to write fiction. And I know you're that way.
I have no interest in writing nonfiction. I mean, writing fiction. That could change someday. I've always been. I don't read novels, except I read classic novels. I haven't in a long time, but I read classic novels, and I love them. I mean, Anna Karenina I just thought was the greatest thing I ever read.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I love the way he writes. And Nikos Kazantzakis, I adore him. But I'm not any of those people. And I don't know if I would change my mind. But right now, I don't have any pull to write a novel or write fiction. I'm kind of gestating with a new nonfiction I'm changing so fast, I'm growing so fast, that I don't know. I write something and then I say, well, this isn't really it. So I have a stack of writing that I'm not sure how I'm going to use it or what I'm going to use it for.
How do you know when it is it? Is it that you recognize something happens inside of you that you know that you're on to something and you're willing to write through pages and pages and create a stack until that happens?
Yes.
Or do you go through the stack at some point and pull something out and say, maybe something's here?
Both. I use a lot of what I've already written, and at some point I know how to rework it. It's kind of like a light bulb going on. It's some sort of gestalt happens. And I just, aha, this, yes. And then sometimes that happens to me and I write in a streak. And then I let it go for a while, which I think is really important so that I can tell what it sounds like. And I'll go back and I'll say, no, this isn't it. This isn't really it either. So that's where I am now. I don't give myself too much of a hard time anymore that I'm not writing. I'm not one of these people that thinks you have to write every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I have a job and I have a deadline, of course I write. I write until it's done. But in terms of forcing myself to write every day just for the sake of writing every day, I don't feel the need to do that. For a long time, I gave myself a hard time about that because in the books, you know, all the writers say, oh, you have to write every day. Da, 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 da. But I don't think that's true, for me anyway.
Do you think that's more true at the beginning or maybe not even then?
It might be more true at the beginning. I'm working on, there's something to be learned from bearing down and there's something to be learned from letting up.
Mm-hmm.
And my work becomes more spacious when I let up and I'm not forcing. And I kind of write like I'm writing music. I write a lot with my ear. I learned that when I wrote those gardening spots for NBC All mm-hmm. News Network Radio. I had 50 seconds because there was an intro and an outro. So I had 50 seconds by the stopwatch to say what I... to come full circle and make a point such as, well, if your geraniums aren't blooming, this is what you need to do. And I learned that with the stopwatch, I found that there were 25 lines I could write, and that would take up the 50 seconds. And so I couldn't have any superfluous words. And I learned by practicing, by having to write five of those a week, I learned it became like a game. It's still a game to me. When I write, the hardest part for me is getting it all out first. And then the game for me, the fun, is going back and editing until and refining and refining and refining until it's just exactly how I want it. And of course, it's never perfect. You have to rip the stuff out of my mm-hmm. hands. But
so how much refining do you do?
I do tons of refining. I don't know how to say how much exactly, mm-hmm. but I'll rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And each time I print it out, it's cleaner and there's more I can see. And I do it completely by ear. I'll read it out loud. I read it out loud and I even will add or take away words so that the cadence is flowing. That the rhythm, I know what the rhythm should sound like in order for it to be conversational.
Mm-hmm.
So I will add syllables. I know exactly how many syllables to add in order for it to flow. So if it's read out loud, it's like it comes out easily like music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so much fun for me. I get off on that.
This is 88.9 FM in Irvine, KUCI. My guest is Judith Handelsman-Smith, author of Growing Myself, A Spiritual Journey Through Gardening, published by Plume. Give your website address before we forget and before before we're through here?
Okay. My website address is judithhandelsman.com, which I always I thought was great. My husband got it for me, except that Handelsman is hard to spell, so bear with me. It's Judith Handelsman, one word, and Handelsman is spelled H-A-N-D-E-L-S-M-A-N. Handel,
like the
composer with an S. Handelsman.
And there, everything can be found.
Everything.
Books,
you can order everything. The tapes, the books, and there's other writing and
wonderful pictures
and articles that have been about me and my work, and it's very pretty. My wonderful husband made it.
Pretty. Do you, in terms of refining, do you read your work to anybody, or are you depending on yourself to know when it's done?
I read it or I give it to somebody to read, but somebody I really trust, and I don't give it to a whole lot of people because everybody has a different take, and you can get very confused. And I'll end up wanting to change everything, and I pretty much and really want to stay with the energy that came out originally because that's I trust that as the raw material. So at this point in my life, my husband is my sounding board, but I have a couple of other friends that I'll read it to or show it to and hear what they have to say. But I notice that if I show it to too many people, I start getting discouraged.
Because of all the, just the plethora of advice or changing or different.
Well, everybody projects
or,
their stuff onto the work. So, it ends up their concerns aren't necessarily my concerns. And I tend to think, well, if they think that, then maybe everybody thinks that. And so I try not to change too much because I've grown to trust my intuition and my ability so that and because I read a lot of other things, I know what works.
You mentioned marketing earlier, how marketing is the thing and the writing is least important. How does that affect you now when you're writing?
I've gotten to the point now. Well, I was so burned out from doing my own marketing and my own PR. Because my editor told me at this point in the publishing business, getting a book deal is just a ticket. The rest is up to you. Because the sad story is that the only people who really get a lot of publicity are the ones who don't need it. That they already have a name.
Right.
So, and I realized, God, I was depressed. I got on Oprah even, which is, you know, the dream to get on Oprah but she didn't say, go buy this book. She didn't hold it up and say, go buy this book. So but I had a whole segment on it. And she didn't say, I love this book, buy this book. And I couldn't believe how depressed I was because the publisher didn't think it was any big deal that I got an Oprah. You know how pathetic that is? And I realized, God, I'm depressed and I was on Oprah? That does not make any sense.
Right.
And I finally just, what I've decided now is the next time I'm not going to go for an advance because if you go for an advance, I don't know, you know, for sure what I'm going to do, but I'm just going to write the book what I want to write and then see what happens. Because if you go for an advance, you have to fit into an awful lot of different... You have to fit into a category. One of the hardest things with this book was it didn't fit into gardening or spirituality. It fit into both. And that is just... They have to be able to pigeonhole the book because...
So they know where to put it.
Where they know where to put it. I was just mind blown over and over and over again. I learned so much, but I did get burned out. I got burned out doing my own PR, my own marketing, my own writing. I did everything. And then I had to show up and do my deal, you know. It was just, and I was heartbroken. The whole process broke my heart. It was my baby, you know. So I think I'm just going to write the next book and then see about selling it. And I stayed true to myself with the last one, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I appreciated the input that my editor gave me at the end. I kept thinking she was going to do something all the way through. I had this romantic vision of what the editor does. But editors, oddly enough, do not edit anymore.
Right.
And it's not written into their job description. They only buy books. So it wasn't until the very end that she wrote me a very good 3-page single-spaced, or maybe it was 5-page single-spaced critique of my first draft, which of course was my 37th draft.
Mm-hmm.
and she wrote, which was devastating, which is what they're supposed to do. I was devastated. I went to bed for a week and felt really horrible because everything she said was what I had been working on in therapy. So I knew it was true. And I rewrote the book. I didn't change so much as she gave me one sentence got me all the way through. She said, you have to orchestrate the reader's experience better because this is something you know at the very core of your being. But other people, you have to take them by the hand and walk them through it. And just from that, I was able to do a really good job telling the whole story.
Well, the book is called Growing Myself, A Spiritual Journey Through Gardening. The author is Judith Handelsman Smith. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
I love this book. You should see my garden is coming along. My African violets, everything's happening. I'm talking to them. We're having a good time.
It's not a gardening book.
No. It's wonderful.
It's about life.
Book. There's a little bit at the end.
There's some there's plenty of gardening
but
in there, but
just
it's
enough.
Yeah.
Not it's good. It's good. It's good what it is. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking.
Of course, that was Judith Handelsman Smith, and she's still sitting here. And next week, my guest will be Jane Ann Phillips. If you have comments or questions, please email me at writersonwriting@aol.com. And to find out more, visit my website at writersonwriting.com. And I'd like to leave you actually with two quotes. One is in Judith's book, an Irma Bombeck quote. Never go to a doctor whose office plants have died. And also, one by Robert Stone, one doesn't consider style because style is. This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you for listening.